Welcome to the Daily French Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Nick. Nice to come back after Jolly Freedom Day relaxation.
Indeed. After and also after your exciting adventures in Mpumalanga. And of course, we are also joined by editor-in-chief, I think he might be, of the Daily Friend, Mr. Michael Morris, who is having some internet trouble, so his camera is not on at the moment. But Michael, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Nick, and thanks very much for inviting me to join you today.
It's always a pleasure to have you. And let's get stuck into the big story of today, and that is, of course, that El Presidente himself, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, is testifying before the Zondo Commission, and this will be going on for the next 4 days. So by the time you watch this, he would have already have given, I think, probably all of his first day testimony when we're recording this. This is sort of right in the middle of it. But he was advised by Gweda Mantashe, who is the ANC's chairperson, that lies have very short legs and he must be sure to absolutely tell the truth. This is what Mantashe advised the president. And I guess the question is, I mean, how big a deal is this? So we've been, I think, a bit critical in the past of the Zondo Commission, but it's not every day that the president of a country goes before a commission on corruption to talk about what happened and whether he had any role in it. So, Gabriel, let's start with that question. Is this a big deal, and what do you think Cyril is going to say?
Yeah, so it is a big deal, but it's a big deal in direct proportion to the probity of the questions asked. In other words, ask President Ramaphosa vague and general questions, open-ended questions, ask him softball questions, and you will get just political rhetoric in answer to that. And this will devolve into yet more circus political theater. By contrast, if you ask very pointed and precise questions, you elevate the significance of this. So far, the questions have been vague. I watched this morning's proceedings. Ramaphosa's initial affidavit. Look, Ramaphosa's out there to say the following, and I think this is good and this is important too. He's saying there's definitely been corruption. It's definitely been a major problem, and we're resolved to try and address this. That, of course, is nothing new. The 54th National Convention of the ANC, where Ramaphosa was elected, said, you know, corruption is a terrible thing and we must end corruption. And we must end faction fighting and so on and so forth. So that's not great in the sense that it's not original. An important point to note from the questions that have come so far is that Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo asked Ramaphosa himself a series of questions about CADA deployment. And watching the sort of SABC and other mainstream coverage of this, you know, they aired it all, but then in their political analysis, I don't think quite saw the point. The point was that that Zondo said, look, there's two ways of doing this. One way is that you just allow the minister to nominate or elect people as per the law, directors general and deputy directors general within the civil service, and that should be fine, and heads of state-owned enterprises that fall under their relevant ambits, and that should be fine. And then the other way of doing this is that you have that, and then you also have this CADA deployment committee within the ANC, which makes recommendations about who should go forward, and when candidates are competing to get a job, like head of SAA or whatever it is, everyone knows who's contending, everyone knows the process, excepting they don't know who's been recommended by the CADA Deployment Committee. The only people who do know that are going to be the CADA Deployment Committee and the minister. And so Zondo kept asking, doesn't that give that person an unfair or at least some kind of advantage, fair or not. And Ramaphosa kept falling back to this sort of, yeah, but I don't think the two processes are mutually exclusive, kind of vague dodge. And then Raymond Zondo said more precisely, my question is it the case that pressure is applied on the minister by the deployment committee in figuring out who should be elevated to these very significant civil service positions? And Ramaphosa laughed. There was lots of laughter. This is very, you could see why Ramaphosa is such a good leader, is that he's very warm and very charming and very gregarious. And, you know, this is hilarious. Yes. Basically, he answers. There is such pressure. In fact, the pressure both goes both ways, because he says the CADA deployment committee is both got a recommending capacity and it's also got a reactive capacity, in the sense that the minister will sometimes say, this is the person who I think is best, and take that to the deployment committee. And then the deployment committee will not be convinced. And so the minister will have to go back again and again, sometimes three or four times, bringing more documentation to prove that the person that they want to elevate is in fact the right person for the job. And Ramaphosa finished this off by saying, you know, I don't want to say that sometimes the minister will browbeat the CADA deployment committee, but in effect, this is what happens. So the other side of that coin is, clearly there is pressure. If the minister has to apply pressure to the CADA deployment committee to get the best candidate for the job through, that also means that the background ambient status is that the CADA deployment committee is applying pressure to the minister. And Zondo's question was, you say that this is for political purposes because you're a political party and you want to elevate people that are not only good at the job, but kind of fit your political ideology. And Ramaphosa was explicit about this, as is the sort of policy background to the CADA deployment committee within the NEC. This is a political thing. You're trying to get politically suitable candidates. And Zondo said, but why do you need the whole committee? Because after all, the minister has been elected by the president, which means the minister is coming from the party. So the political aspect is already there in the usual process, where a president elects a cabinet and then they go on to elevate directors general and deputies director general and SOEs, CEOs, and so on. Why do you need this extra thing? And there really was no good answer for that, other than that, you know, well, we need it and we don't think that this is incompatible with getting the best person for the job.
Very interesting. I'm glad that the role of the CADA deployment committee is coming up, because, of course, Cyril Ramaphosa was heading that committee, I believe, from somewhere around 2014, 2015, somewhere from that time. And, of course, he was Zuma's deputy president. He was in the senior position in the ANC, you know, right through the Zuma years. He gave many speeches in defense of Zuma's government. So it's kind of difficult to imagine, especially as Zondo is now sort of probing some of these questions around CADA deployment, that Ramaphosa really didn't know or didn't have any ability to influence what was going on. Michael, do you have anything to comment on that, and also what Gabriel's just said?
Indeed. And I think that also underscores the fact that the fate of so many people hinges on how Ramaphosa sees the role that he played and indeed defends the very notion of CADA deployment. as Gabriel mentioned, Gwede Mantashe said, you know, he must go out there till the truth without bounds. And I suppose the question that people will be asking themselves watching the submission and the reportage on it is, you know, has Ramaphosa actually met this challenge, and can he afford to, in a way? You know, it's one has a sense of, you know, the preservation of the ANC is this more or less unified ruling party appears to be the kind of overriding objective of so much of what the party does and what it says in public. Will genuine revelations that really do shed light on state capture and the role of CADA deployment, for instance, you know, serve to paint an accurate picture of what really happened. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of questions about what we're likely to learn from the presentation, from the submission of the president.
So, Gabriel, let's talk for a second about the sort of larger strategic strategy here, maybe what Ramaphosa is looking at in the bigger picture. So, of course, it is an election year. October this year, we are seeing the local government elections. And this is the first big electoral test for the ANC after, you know, all these corruption stories, after Ramaphosa's honeymoon shine, I think, has worn off a bit. And after COVID, of course, and the lockdown. So it could potentially be quite a tough election for them. And so my sense is that Ramaphosa wanted to go into the Zondo Commission thing and then emerge looking like he had been cleansed of the corruption so that he could draw a line between him and the Zuma era and say, look, I'm the clean, bright new future. Do you think that's right? Do you think there's anything else here going on?
No, I think that's clearly the case. And I go back to the polling done by the Institute, but also by Mark Data, commissioned by ENCA and run by R.W. Johnson in 2017, when there was the internal battle within the ANC between Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa. And what you find there is that Ramaphosa was 6 to 8 times more popular within the ANC than Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. And you also find the reasons within the ANC's voting base. And you find the reasons for that where they saw him to be a more business-friendly leader, whereas she was a more radical economic transformation-friendly leader. So people's emphasis on jobs growth, increasing investment, protecting property rights, improving accountability, that all seemed to fit with Ramaphosa. Now, notice that radical economic transformation thereafter, after Ramaphosa became leader, was a term that went rather out of fashion. And people would talk about the Esmachashule faction or the Dlamini Zuma faction or the Zumarite faction or the Zupta faction versus the Ramaphosa faction. But there was no ideological bent. And the reason for that was that Ramaphosa pursued exactly the policies of radical economic transformation, his signature policy being, of course, expropriation without compensation, but also introducing a minimum wage, which is equal to the median wage, which I just spoke to one of the leading business school professors in Oxbridge, who said, who just laughed and couldn't believe it and then looked it up and then laughed some more and sort of thought he had to pour himself a drink. This is crazy way to drive up unemployment, but of course it's good for unions who use that as a basis to negotiate from. And there's various other policies we can talk about in Ramaphosa's arsenal, which are purely RET. But now we see RET returning as there's the one faction and then there's the RET faction. And it seems to me that Ramaphosa has looked at what ANC voters want. And he and his acolytes are creating the impression that there's really a policy disagreement here. That's one way to draw a line between him and Zuma. And the other way to draw a line is this sort of theatrical lampooning of corruption, for him to come forward in front of the Zondo Commission and say, look, I'm against corruption, and you can tell I'm against corruption because I'm submitting myself to this process where I will say that I'm against corruption, and I'll say that it's very bad and that you mustn't be corrupt and that it's very, very bad and it must never happen. And you keep saying that, and you might convince people that you had nothing to do with it. So there's two senses in which Ramaphosa seems to be distancing himself from the ANC's failures. And the one is by allowing the other side to be portrayed as being different in terms of policy, where such differences don't actually line up with the policies proposed. And the other being that there's a difference in terms of an attitude publicly towards corruption. But of course, everyone from the Makhashule faction or the Dlamini Zuma faction or whatever is also against corruption if you ask them. So these differences aren't deep, but they are performative. And I think that there is a real impact of that performance on the body politic. I think some people will be impressed by this. I've got no doubt that my friends in the foothills of Westcliff, sort of middle upper class professionals who were delighted when Ramaphosa came to power, much like I was, and then unlike me, didn't really care much for his policies, just thought that doesn't matter. What matters is that he's a really nice guy, are going to think, well, look, this proves that he's a really nice guy. And on that basis, are going to be looking to vote for the ANC.
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. Michael, anything to add before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, I think we, you know, one of the things is stepping right back and looking at these things as the public sees it or sees them. We're talking about a kind of corruption blur. You know, there's just constant every day. There's something new. There's a new revelation. There's, you know, the Zondo Commission has been going on now for I don't know how long. I can't remember when exactly it was started, but it's almost become a fixture now. Yeah, yeah.
Back,
I mean, it's
back when Nicholas and I had clean shaven.
There we go. And there's this sort of blizzard of words and revelations, which with every passing day become less and less meaningful in the absence of action. You know, as Gabriel says, it's the Ramaphosa is the guy who speaks up, and he's the why his anti-corruption people love that, they respect that in him. He seems to be kind of cleaning up the show, but in fact, in the absence of action, of cases, of imprisonment for those who are guilty, it is just, you know, it becomes this blur, this quite amorphous thing that people become accustomed to. You know?
Exactly. I think scandal fatigue sets in and then no one cares anymore. And I think that's very much been, you know, every week at Zondo, there's someone else talking about how they were, I don't know, selling out country's mining policy for crates of whiskey or something.
Indeed.
I think now we're all numb to it, which is perhaps what those accused wanted.
Yeah.
Anyway, let us move on to our next story overseas. Now, best actor at the Oscars was won by Anthony Hopkins. And of course, as social media does, there was a backlash, which is a word that sees far too much usage in the modern media, I think, these days, particularly because I think that the least newsworthy thing you could possibly report on is that people are angry on the internet, because this is always true about everything. But in this case, of course, there was anger because the late actor Chadwick Boseman was expected to win Best Actor. There was a sort of expectation, there was a woke racial expectation here that he would win because, you know, he was this great black actor and he had died recently. And so that was a lot of the direction of the anger. And they said, oh, look, they've just given it to an old white man. Of course, his family has come forward, Chadwick Boseman's family, to say that his brother, Chadwick Boseman's brother, said that his brother would have been the first to wish Hopkins the best following the Saturday night win, and said that this whole furor was a bit silly. Gabriel, what do you make of this? Is this sort of the sign of where we are, culturally speaking, that there's outrage when people of a certain race don't win an award? What's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, very much there is. I think awards matter because of something I call the esteem market, which we discuss a lot in Two Crickets and Thorntree. Basically, the thought is that a racialist is someone who draws pride from their race. Of course, there are known racialists in South Africa. I think Musi Maimane is perhaps the saddest case, in the sense that he had so much potential, and his pride in his race came very much before the fall. But yeah, there are people of all races who think that they're special because other people that happen to look like them are special. And so it's very important to those people that people of the same race win awards and are seen to be special, are seen to be highly esteemed. And it's as if, you know, if a black person wins, then all the black people are better off. And if a Hispanic person wins, all the Hispanic people are better off. And there are definitely analogs in South Africa. And for that reason, whenever there are award ceremonies, there are people who think this way, who count the beans and see how many of their own team won. And if many did, then they say, oh, you see how special I am, even though I'm just a couch potato. And if they don't win, then they say, oh, you see how oppressive society is, I'm very special, and so is everyone who looks like me, and this hasn't been recognized, and so this is very terrible, and we need more laws or something to stop this kind of thing from happening. Good for the Boseman family for sticking up against this. I think what is interesting about this is you know, the last couple of Oscars have been billed as not black enough by these kinds of esteem entrepreneurs. And this time, that was a difficult charge to make, in the sense that, you know, Best Picture, went to Nomadland, which is directed by a Chinese-American woman, and the Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress and Best Supporting Actor both went to persons of color in the American nomenclature. And the sort of technical awards, more persons of color won than ever before. So it really was the sort of most rainbow event that one could reasonably hope for. In fact, I think, you know, if you go by demographic representation, more so even than the basic demography of America would suggest. And for that reason, in part, the Oscars seem to hope that they would really milk this for as much as they can. Obviously, very low glamour event, the usual beautiful flesh pots walking around, dripping in jewels, almost in dresses, but mainly in sort of t-shirts that just cover the bum, and being sort of fixated on by the cameras that draws the crowds. This couldn't happen under conditions of social distancing. No rumors about sniffing cocaine in the bathrooms that we usually get, or Jack Nicholson telling dirty jokes and backstage. All that kind of delicious gossip stuff was absent. And so this had to be the sort of purified nunnery of wokeness event. And in the expectation that the dead black man would win, of course, because he's dead and he's a black man, never mind the merits of the relative performances. By the way, I think Chadwick Boseman's performance was strong, just not the strongest. But people who weren't thinking like that, who were instead thinking through these lenses, expected so much that he would win that the order of the Oscars was changed. Usually Best Picture comes last because that's, of course, the greatest accolade for a complete work. Instead of that being last in the ceremony, that was put third last, and Best Actress and Best Actress were put last. Both were expected to be people of color. Neither, in fact, were. And to make the embarrassment worse, Anthony Hopkins, being 83 and in Wales, didn't see fit to go through to London and sit in a little sort of couch circle, and the organizers refused to allow anyone to zoom in. Reportedly, he and his producers had tried to ask if something like that could be done. They said, no, this is a no zoom ceremony. You've got to get in there. So he wasn't there. So there was no one to make a thank you speech. And his prize was declared by Joaquin Phoenix, I think because he'd won it last time, or he'd just very well recognized. But Joaquin Phoenix is like the anti-celebrity celebrity. So he wasn't doing any gushing or building up or master of ceremonies exercises. He's sort of like, when I said, hey guys, okay, Anthony Hopkins won. Cut to blank screen. Okay, bye. And then that's it. So it's like
no, that's the way to do it.
Anti-climax, which really didn't shoot the fireworks of wokeness into the air that a lot of people have been hoping for. And I think that if there's one more point, there's something to be taken from that which is good. I think so many award ceremonies have become about the entertainment that people have lost a sense of the estimation. There really is something very profound about the right person winning the Nobel Prize or the right person winning the Oscar or within any industry, the award going to the person who's really done the best of the job, which is very serious. When experts say, look, amongst us, we elevate this person to say this person has done the best of what we're all trying to do. That's something to be taken seriously. And maybe in the absence of all the gush, people will take it seriously and go to the movies and see what it's all about, see why this very storied, knighted actor's portrayal of a man going insane through dementia was considered so serious. And of course, dementia does seem to be just the perfect analog, as diseases go, for the state of American politics. And I'll say nothing about America's current leaders or anyone else in that regard, but it's just a thing to ponder.
Right. It is worth also pointing out that in a video posted, I think on Monday, Anthony Hopkins did say that he's very grateful to the Academy for electing him the winner, and he said that he wanted to pay tribute to Chadwick Boseman, who was taken from us far too early. Gabriel, I agree with you completely. The Oscars are important, and they do affect how people see the world and what people think is good or bad or cool or not. But from my perspective, I will say, and I told you guys the story just beforehand, I've never taken them that seriously. And I once heard an American film and movie producer say that he spoke to someone from the Academy who gets to vote on who wins the awards. And he asked her, have you seen any films? And she said, no, I don't really watch films these days. And he said, but are you going to vote in the Academy Awards? And she said, yes, of course. It matters so much to the younger actors. So I don't take them particularly seriously. Michael, what's your take on the Oscars in general, and also what Gabriel's been talking about here?
Just a few thoughts. I thought Hopkins's thank you speech from Wales was a marvel of brevity and good grace. Actually, it was shortened to the point and really in a way wonderful to watch. Gabriel used a term with the phrase among us, you know, the ability to celebrate who is the best among us, and that really captures the finest ideal. I think it's tragic that that race esteem in a way has been allowed to gain such credence, when in fact we can all gain equivalent esteem from all human achievement, and that really is the ideal. And why can't we? And a lot of us do, I think. You watch Jimi Hendrix, I think back to my childhood. I was thinking a bit earlier, actually, of how I'm old enough, and I don't know if either of you has ever watched it, but old enough to remember Anthony Hopkins in Ryan's Daughter, the David Lean film, set in Ireland. Absolutely marvelous performance. And also in his portrayal in the Kazuo Ishiguro novel, the film based on the
Kazuo Ishiguro Remains novel, of the Day.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely wonderful. So it's great, you know. It's wonderful to be able to celebrate a life of such great performances. But the same is perfectly true of a Jimi Hendrix, for instance. I mean, the outstanding guitarist of the modern age, I think. And race simply doesn't come into it. It's simply to actually marvel at these wonderful talents that fellow humans have, and that really is that's a wonderful esteem economy, to use Gabriel's very useful expression. I think it's a shame, but once again, I mean, wonderful that Hopkins is the winner, and that the Boseman family have spoken up for that very idea.
I agree. That was very very classy of them to come to the defense of Anthony Hopkins. I must say that there always strikes me as a degree of just cynicism from the sort of race nationalist types who want to use, who suddenly say that, like, I don't know, what the color of the skin of a Disney princess is, or who wins an Oscar. They didn't really care about these things too much until all of a sudden they realized they could be used to justify their own ends, and then suddenly it becomes the greatest issue in the world. So I never really take some of this performance seriously, because I think that people do play it up for nefarious ends. I don't know, Gabriel.
If we're going to stick to this one, so I think that yes, part of it does come from the crowd, but part of it comes from winners, and this is why I say these award ceremonies are important. When someone wins an award, the whole world is looking at them, and they're looking at them through this lens of excellence. Wow, this person is being highly esteemed. How does that person then deal with it? I think religion is great, because passionate and sincere religious people really do feel the humility of their own talents being sort of graced by a higher power. And so the standard answer to what to do in this situation for a religious person is to thank their creator. Secular folk often end up thanking their parents. I think if you want to, my favorite awards receipt speech of all time was James Coetzee when he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, who said, "Mom, Dad, you're both dead now, but you know, finally you can be proud of me. But now you can be certain that, like, this risk that I took to be a writer has not embarrassed the family and has not embarrassed you, who gave an ineffable amount of energy and love to me. And I think that's really sincere and really good. Gavin Wood, when he won for Tsotsi Best Foreign Movie, he said this goes out to all South Africans. So we all South Africans are part of the team. It was a South African story, and it was nice for us to win as a country in that sense. But of course, there are lots of people who say, this goes out to everyone of my race. White people don't say that. They used to say that in one way or another sort of generations ago. They don't anymore, and that's damn good thing, in my opinion. But members of other races do sometimes say that, and they encourage this. So it's not just the outsiders. I think it's also the stars themselves who don't know how to count their blessings or thank their lucky stars.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
And thereby motivate this kind of, sort of lumping of people together by how they look and then loathing of the other.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly.
Like Hopkins, who just doesn't look right to win.
Yes. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today, unfortunately. Although, of course, the Oscars is a fascinating thing that you can go on forever about, because it has all these like weird little cultural things going on with it and these weird psychological things. But anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we will see you tomorrow on The Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.